Sherbindo said he's not a philosopher. If anything, he's a poet. What's the difference between a poet and a philosopher? A philosopher lives in the abstract mind, in the intellect. A poet lives in life. He cares about truths of life, not just abstract truths of mind. This book is a book about life. Maybe not just the life the way we lead it, but the life that we can have. So in this chapter, he brings together philosophy and life to look at what are the implications of all that we have learned so far to the way we live our life. And he asks a very profound and yet a very simple question, a question that we should all be asking ourselves all the time, but we rarely do in our whole life. What's the aim of life? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do with my life? And what does all that Sri Aurobindo has taught us, told us, and shown us have to do with life and the way we live it, and the aim of life? What's the aim of life for Lydia? Everybody has an aim. What is the aim of life for Lydia? What do you think if we asked her, what's the aim of life, what she would say? She wanted to get married first. But that's what she would say. I agree with you. But really what she wants is excitement. After marriage, she can't say the aim of life is over. What she wants is constant excitement, constant vital intensity. She wants to run around, play with the officers, become the center of attention, make noise. She wants intensity, vital intensity. What about Charlotte? What's the aim of life for Charlotte? Huh? Contented. That's her temperament, but what's her aim? Why? What does she think? What's her objective? She wants security, no? I must take care of myself. I don't have anything. If this man will give me a house and food and a home and respectability and safety, I'm okay. She wants security. No? For that, see, and she says it's quite all right. I get my own little parlor. I get my chickens. He's out in the garden. And everything is okay. Okay means I'm secure. What about for Collins? What's the aim of life for Collins? Okay, that's certainly how he spends his time and energy, but what's his motive? What's he really after? Religion. He never talks about religion. He certainly never thinks about God or talks about... What is the aim of life for him? He wants to come up. His father was poor and uneducated. He's got a college education. He's got a respectable job, a living. He's got a patroness. What does he want? He wants to come up. He wants to be able to go and introduce himself to Mr. Darcy. He wants to have respectability in society. He's climbing from a lower social level. And he keeps talking about Lady Catherine and everything because he thinks it raises his prestige. What about Wickham? What's the aim of life for Wickham? He's constantly in debt. He constantly has to leave one place and go to another place before he gets caught. And he's been molesting the girls. He's been borrowing money everywhere. And he keeps moving around in order to escape he's afraid of every shadow. When he finds out that Darcy's come to Meryton, he's afraid he's going to be exposed. He runs away with Lydia, really, because he has to run away. He already owes too much money in Brighton, so he's running away again. Wickham's main goal now is survival. He should survive somehow. What about Jane? What's her goal? What's she really live for? What's the purpose of her life? She wants to be known as a good person. Cut it. She wants to be known as a good person. She's a pleasant girl. She doesn't want to trouble anybody. She doesn't want it to make a demand of anybody. She doesn't want anybody to think or to think badly of her. She doesn't want anybody to accuse her that she's running after Wickham or, Bingley or after his money or anything else. Cut it. How about Mrs. Bennet? What's the aim of life for her? She wants to assert herself, to triumph over Lady Lucas, to proclaim her. She's strong. She wants to exercise her power, push people around a little, push herself up, assert herself. She wants to be more and more important. She wants to dominate those around her, including her husband, and keep taking initiative. She has an irresistible urge to take initiative, most of which end her in hot soup. But still, that urge is there. I must act. I must do something. I must get something. How about Mr. Hurst, Louisa's husband, Carolyn's brother-in-law, the guy who's always sleeping on the sofa, getting drunk, playing cards? I don't know. Does he really enjoy life? Does he enjoy life? He seems to me to be just vegetating. He's just a physical vegetable. That's an insult to the vegetables, I guess, but he wants to be comfortable at every moment. He has no thought of the future. He has no active initiative to do anything. He doesn't even relate to other people. He doesn't even seek popularity. He's not curious about anything. He doesn't want to learn anything. Let me lie down. Let's play cards. Let me drink some more wine or whatever he drinks. That's all. Even though he lives in aristocracy, there's no thought, no curiosity about anything. He doesn't want to do anything. He doesn't seem to want to be anything. How about Carolyn? What's the aim of life for Carolyn? Of course, she would like to marry Darcy, no doubt. But whether she marries Darcy or not, Darcy's a means to an end. You're certainly not going to tell me she's in love with Darcy. She's certainly not in love with Darcy. She may want to marry him. Why does she want to marry him? That's true. Maybe her aim is only competition with Lizzie, but she must have had an aim before she met Lizzie also. So her father was a businessman, earned money. Her one goal is to say we are not middle class people who have earned money in business. We belong to the upper class. We belong to the Arab. We are civilized people. We're cultured people. So her dress, her haughty behavior, her fancy way of walking and talking and all of that, everything she does is she wants to pretend that she's an aristocrat and look down on everybody else as lower than her. No. That seems to be the scope for her. How about Elizabeth? What's the aim of her life? True. True. She wants love. Compromise. I agree. The thought that comes to me, the word that comes to me is she wants to take joy in life. We would think everybody wants to take. She's a happy person who wants to find joy in life. You would think that everybody wants to find joy in life. But Mr. Hurst, Wickham, Mrs. Bennett, none of them are, Carolyn, none of them are acting as if joy is the purpose of life. She wants to be people who are with her, people who are pleasant, with whom she can be harmonious. She's not trying to dominate anybody. She's not trying to poke anybody. She doesn't like to be poked, of course, but she likes to be happy. Harmonious. She wants Jane's happiness. That's good intention. She has a romantic aspiration. When money is presented to her from Collins, or security is presented to her, or Darcy's presented to her, if it doesn't come with joy, if it doesn't come with harmony, if it doesn't come with something very pleasant, it doesn't appeal to her. She stands up above, and you said individuality. She prides herself on her self-respect and her individuality. Not that she's trying to assert herself, her individuality, but you can't touch her freedom. Even her mother can't tell her who to marry. It's very interesting because when Mrs. Bennett tries to dominate her, she doesn't fight back. She doesn't say, well, I'm an independent person and I'll marry who I want. She keeps quiet. But she refuses to compromise that essential individuality. As an individual, she honors her freedom and her right to choose. Very interesting, no? She doesn't claim it. She doesn't proclaim it. But she acts as if she has to honor her. I have a right. I have a choice. Even when Lady Catherine comes and abuses her in Longbourn, she doesn't assert herself. She simply says, I cannot live my life to please you. I cannot live my life the way you want me to live it. That's not right for me. I should do what makes me happy. How about Mr. Bennett? Huh? He wants to escape, I heard that much. From the real? From the reality of life, huh? Of course, I think you meant from the reality of life. That I agree with you, certainly. Of course, he wants a peaceful, quiet existence. It's not that he's lazy. He's not like Mr. Hurst, but he doesn't want to be disturbed. But he wants a certain enjoyment in life. But we see that ultimately he's touched at one point where we really see what's important to him. When he finds out that Mr. Gardner, or thinks that Mr. Gardner, has paid for Lydia's wedding, he says, well, I have to repay that money. Now, what does that tell us about this man? If he's really a man after comfort or convenience or quietude, that's what his temperament prefers. But his aim of life is he's a gentleman. He's the son of a gentleman. He's the most important person in that village. He wants to maintain his honor as a gentleman, even if it means repaying a fabulous sum, which he has no way of doing, and sacrificing all of the comforts that others have for that. So he has a value which to him is more important. He would like all those things you say, but he has a value which is more important to him than all the things that he would make him feel comfortable, even the peace and quiet in the library. How about Darcy? What's the aim of life for Darcy? If we see Darcy in the beginning of the story, we think it's pretty clear. The aim of Darcy's life is only to maintain his sense of superiority and self-importance. But that turns out to be what he's consciously thinking and doing. But when his emotions are touched, he's willing to completely turn himself inside out for that love he feels for Elizabeth. Even if it means spending a fabulous sum on Wickham and helping his enemy, even if it means making Mrs. Bennet and Lydia Mrs. Bennet his mother-in-law and Lydia his sister, he's willing to do, and Wickham his brother-in-law. This is more important to him than anything else. He's willing to become unselfish. He's willing to do heroic acts. He's willing to sacrifice his pride and humble himself for a higher emotion which he feels is more valuable. Some of you know the story of Dr. Thorne. I think it's been told, no? Discussed. Huh? Yes, no, no. Appa writes about it a lot, but you've not been using it as an example. Dr. Thorne's a poor country doctor. Poor means he survives and everything. He's not in poverty, but he works very hard just to maintain his house and take care of his niece, Mary, who he's adopted. But when a fabulous sum of money is offered for Mary, the one important thing for him is, I must be true. I must be right. I cannot make even an inch of claim of that money for Mary. I must do the right thing. For him, it's an extraordinary example of the value of honesty and integrity. For whatever benefit may come to me or my family, I cannot compromise. I won't even allow myself to think of taking an advantage that's not due to me. He has made the value of honesty and integrity to perfection. He's not even trying to show off and say, I'm a very honest man. Nobody knows this struggle that's going on in him. He never speaks to anybody. He never tells anybody that the inheritance of Roger is likely to come to his niece, Mary. But in his own conscience, he's so careful not to have a single thought of claiming that money until the law absolutely proclaims that it's due to Mary. It's an extraordinary case. What about Yudhishthira? What's the aim of life for Yudhishthira? At least that's one character everybody knows. I think it can do better than that. Huh? Righteousness. Whose righteousness? Oh, it's an important question. Whose righteousness? Do you think so? I don't know. I never thought that Yudhishthira went to war because he wanted to set right things. He wants to consider that he's righteous. He wants to be considered that he is righteous. That's my thought. I never got the feeling he went to war because evil must be conquered in Bharat. And must be the good must be restored. That's what Krishna felt. But I must do, and it comes out. So his aspiration, I think, is to go to heaven. He must go to the moksha doesn't arise. They're not rishis. They're not thinking of moksha. He wants. When he dies, and you know that there are several versions of the Bharata, but his idea is, I should live righteous life so that I will end up with the gods. Huh? After the life. I may sacrifice here, I may lose my kingdom, I may lose my wife, I may lose everything, but finally I should be recognized as being honorable. That I should go to heaven, whatever heaven it may be. How about Shankara? What's the aim of life for him? I think that's simple. Huh? You said it. Moksha. For him, it's moksha, the whole aim. Of course, if it's really moksha, why he spent 16 years wandering around India setting up mutts is another question. But at least he says the aim for all of us should be moksha. And Buddha had a slight variation on that. Buddha said the aim is to get out of this suffering of life, go to nirvana, which is another version of the moksha. So it raises the question, who's right? If there really is a truth of life, which one of these characters is really following the truth of life? What is the truth of life for us? What's the aim of life for us? What are we here for? Are we going to be like Lydia or Mr. Hurst or Wickham or Mrs. Bennett or Lady Catherine, we have left her out for the moment. The Lady Catherine has a name. Anybody? What's the aim for Lady Catherine? I think you're close, but she's already got a surprise. I think she wants to maintain the temporary advantage that she has. Her aim is to cling to the past. The age of aristocracy is over. French Revolution has taken place. All of the aristocrats are losing their head. She wants to maintain the past. She wants to live based on the past advantage that her class had and continue it in the future. She's not even trying to increase it. She just wants to maintain it. And nothing should disturb the status quo. Everything's fine now. The world is perfect because she's an aristocrat. And she can look down at it and be benevolently helping other people and help them fix up their closets and get maids for them and governesses for their children and so forth and so on. Get people married and so on. Who's right? What does this have to tell us? Everybody's right on their term. Everybody's right on their term. You're a very democratic, right? This is a democratic system. God enables everybody to do anything they want to do, right? I wish he had said that in chapter one. It would have made it so easy for us. You do whatever you want to do. It doesn't matter because you're all divine, right? It's a nice, simple summary of Sri Aurobindo. Much easier to understand anyway than why spend all of these months and months reading Life Divine. It's such a simple philosophy. Well, He says if you really want to answer this question, first thing we should be clear about is, what is reality? What is the nature of reality? Because the aim of our life should be based on what reality is. So he starts off this chapter with a review. And for me, I thought it's the best few pages in the whole book. If you want to get the essence of what he says about reality in about 5-6 pages, he just goes one point after another and says, this is really what I'm saying is the nature of reality. And let's start by hearing from him what he has told us, how he summarizes all the first 400 pages of the book, and what he has told us so far, and then we look at what this tells us about the aim of life. And I'm going to go back to PowerPoint because that was requested, and maybe it'll help some of you just because I've written some of these statements down as we go through them. He makes about 7 or 8 statements about the nature of reality. The first, most fundamental of all is that the absolute is the origin, support, and secret reality of all things. It is self-existent and self-aware. The real reality, the fundamental reality of everything in the universe and outside the universe, we'll see, is the absolute, a spiritual, divine, infinite, absolute, indefinable, indescribable, absolute, but it's self-aware. And it is the secret reality of all things, and that all things is very important, because it doesn't mean that the absolute is only in some things and not other things. It is in everything. There is nothing outside the absolute. There is nothing that is not founded on the absolute. This is his fundamental statement. And it sounds very similar to the statement in the tradition about Brahman. Brahman is the absolute, except that Brahman, he doesn't use the word here because Brahman has become used in different ways and interpreted in different ways. But if you mean Brahman in this sense, that all is Brahman, that there is nothing that is not Brahman, then this is what he says is the fundamental reality. His second point is the absolute manifests itself. It expresses itself in two ways, in two terms. It is all being. There is no being, there is nothing that exists that is not the absolute. But he also says, it is all becoming. There is nothing that happens. There is no form that takes place. There is no event that takes place. There is no unfolding. There's no universe that is also not the absolute. So it's a fundamental statement because we know being in the world, we are in the absolute. The notion that we have to get out of the world to get to the absolute, everything is the absolute. It's not just that the becoming is the absolute. It is the absolute that becomes. It is the divine that becomes as world, as universe. The universe is not the opposite of the divine. Life is not the opposite of the divine. Matter is not the opposite of the divine. It's a becoming. It's a manifestation of the divine. This is the second fundamental point. Third, how do we know this absolute? We cannot describe this absolute in words. The mind cannot conceive of this absolute. The closest that we can come to describing the nature of this absolute when we have a spiritual perception, not a mental perception. When we have a spiritual experiences, we can say this absolute has three qualities. It's an infinite existence, an infinite consciousness, and an infinite bliss. It is an infinite existence, everything that exists. It's a conscious existence. It's not a big stone or a dead planet. It's alive, it's awake. It knows, it's self-aware. And its awareness is an infinite bliss. So the nature of this absolute, the nature of the universe and the nature of everything beyond this universe is a conscious being in delight. This is a universe of delight, but the universe is a very small place compared to the absolute. Beyond all universes is this being, infinite being of delight. Rather, the only thing that is, the only thing that exists here or any place else or beyond all places is an infinite being of delight. And it doesn't matter how far you travel in the universe or beyond a million universes, you cannot get out of this being that's infinite, aware, conscious, delight. That is the nature of reality. There's nothing beyond it. There's nothing behind it. There's nothing other than it. Reality is an infinite being of delight. It must tell us something about life. Now, he says, but this being is one being. It's not multiplicity of beings. It's not many, many beings. It's one being. Yet, it contains an infinite multiplicity of itself. All multiplicity is only itself. It is always one. It has always been one. It will always be one, even at this very minute when we all feel that we're separate, it is still one. And we are an infinite multiplicity of that one. So everything is that. And there is nothing that is not that. This one, this infinite being, presents itself to our cosmic experience, that is to us, in the universe. There are three ways in which it manifests itself. In the most obvious way, it manifests itself to us as ourself, as an individual, and as many other individual beings. Lots of people, that's the way we think of the world. It's filled with lots of people who are individual. But when we gain a deeper understanding, we discover a deeper perception, we discover in ourselves that there's a self in us, a spiritual self in us. And there's a spiritual self in everybody else. And actually, our self, myself and yourself and everybody's self is the same self. And it shouldn't surprise us to find out it's the self of that divine being that's there in each of us. But we also discover that the universe, the world as we know it, the cosmos as we know it, itself is a being. Itself is a conscious being. The universe is alive. Sri Aurobindo's Mother India is a soul, is alive. The universe is a being, and that self is that is the being of the universe too. The absolute is the being of the universe. The universe is an expression of that being. But it's not limited to that. Because when we rise in spiritual experience, we find out beyond the universe and beyond all universes, there's a transcendent self. There's a self that lives in timelessness, formlessness, eternal. It's infinite. It's conscious, self-aware, in bliss. It's the same self. So to us, in our experience in the universe, this one absolute Satchidananda, whatever we call it, expresses as three things. All of us, the universe, and God, divinity, or whatever we want to call that which is beyond the universe. It's all three. That's not the way we think of it. That's not the way I think of it. I wake up in the morning and I want to see the weather and what's going on in the world and what other people are doing as if they're all separate from me. And if I can manage to think of Mother or God or the divine or anything, it's a third thing way, way far away. But the point is, there's only one. We are all expressions of one. What we think of as the transcendent divine is not the absolute. It's a part of the absolute. What we think of the world, the universe, is not the absolute. It's a part of the absolute. What we think of as our self, true self, and the self in everybody else, we are all expressions of that one being. So the closest I can come to an analogy is if every character in the story is an expression of Jane Austen's creative consciousness. It's really Jane Austen is there behind all the characters. All the events are created by Jane Austen. It's her person, it's her story. All the worlds that she conceives of, everything is her. They're various expressions of her. Then he tells us this infinite being has two aspects to it, impersonal and personal. Because when you look at the universe, depending on what you look at, if you look at the physical universe, you would say if you look at nature, it looks impersonal. There are impersonal forces. There's electricity, there's climate, there's gravity. There are laws or rules by which things happen, truths, powers that happen. But when we look at life, when we look at our life, we see people, personalities. We don't feel like we're just impersonal laws. We feel very personal. And when you experience the divine, of course, the yani may experience the truths of the spirit, but the bhakta feels the divine as a being. So these things are there at every level. There's a personal and impersonal aspect. And he says that both are aspects of the divine. What we call the divine as a person, Mother is a person, and the divine as an universal love or universal truth. Truth is not very personal. Truth sounds very impersonal. But love and truth, love and the lover are inseparable. You can't have love without the lover. They're two sides or two expressions of the same reality. So all that we think of as impersonal, like society, the law, this is the law, this is that we have to follow. How do you distinguish the law from the policeman or the law from the judge? The judge is a personal expression of the law. The law is an impersonal expression of the decisions made by the parliament and by carried out by the police and by the judge. They're two. You can't have one without the other. You can't have law without the people who make it. And he says when this infinite reality manifests itself in the universe, it manifests at seven stages or seven levels. In the upper hemisphere, it's Satchidananda. Satchidananda itself to us is beyond all manifestation, but for the absolute, Satchidananda itself is manifestation. It's the first form that it takes. In the lower hemisphere, it's what we know, matter, life, mind. They are all manifestations of one reality. It's not just all of us are one reality. All the planes of existence are manifestations of one reality. And in between the upper hemisphere and the lower hemisphere is this plane he calls supermind, which is the power that takes the spirit, Satchidananda, and transforms it into forms of the universe that become mind, life, and matter. And of course, we know now that we have evolved from matter to life, and now we're at mind. And he's been telling us that we don't stop there, that the next being, which is our future destiny, is we will discover and manifest supermind. And when we manifest supermind, we'll be completing the circuit between the upper three and the lower three, because supermind lives in Satchidananda. Supermind experiences and knows Satchidananda. Supermind manifests Satchidananda. So supermind is not the middle step. It's the connection that puts it all together. It reunites the upper and the lower hemisphere. We'll become whole, and the manifestation will become whole. So these seven or eight principles, I think there's nothing here we haven't discussed before. In fact, he's had chapters on each of these principles. You remember on Satchidananda, he had a chapter on the pure existent and another one on conscious force and two chapters on Ananda. And supermind, he's got three or four chapters, and mind, and then life, he had two chapters, and matter, he had two chapters. So, and then he had the sevenfold cord of being, which shows this slide. So all of these things we've discussed, here he has summarized the truth, fundamental truths of reality. Now that we know these truths, it should be easy for us to figure out what's the aim of life, right? What does all this have to do with us? That's the question. That's the question here. So this chapter examines what conclusions we can draw from this truth about what we should be doing in life, why we're here, why we've come, what is our destiny, and what we should be doing to get there. And he says there are essentially four basic theories of existence. There are actually hundreds and hundreds of variations on those theories, but if you really look at them, it all breaks down into four main categories. And every theory of existence, of the reality of the world, and consequently of the aim of life, comes within one of these four. And we'll go through them. These are the four. The supracosmic means the real truth of existence is the transcendence. I'm not going to use the word absolute because in his term, the absolute includes the manifestation. But we understand the real truth of existence is only what's outside the cosmos. At the other end, we have the materialist. It's the terrestrial view. It's that the world is real. Earth is real. Life is real. What we see and touch is real. And beyond this world, God is just something that we imagine. It's something we invent to make other people behave properly, or because we're not satisfied here and wish there was something better than what's here. The materialist takes the opposite view. This is all that is. In between, we know there are those who dream of living in heaven, like Yudhishthira. I want to be good on earth so that I can live in heaven. There are other worlds in between the absolute or the supracosmic transcendent. There are higher planes of existence, and there are those who say that the real purpose is to reach heaven. That's the Christian view. We're here on earth only to reach heaven. And the fourth is what he calls the integral or synthetic view, which is his view. So in this chapter, he goes through these four views. Each is a view of what is reality, and each comes to some conclusion about what's the aim of life. Clear? Any question, any doubt so far? So let's look first at the supracosmic view. We know it. We've discussed it. He mentions it in almost every chapter. You can easily, and the best way to think about this is Shankara, Advaita. The supreme reality is alone entirely real. Nothing else is really real. The absolute, the Parabrahman, is the origin and goal of all existence. All else is only an interlude. It has no real significance. So if we are on earth, the real purpose on earth, of being on earth, is to get to moksha. Moksha is the supracosmic. It's not a heaven. It's not filled with apsaras and other heavenly beings. It's not filled with the heavenly mangoes and so many things and beautiful mountains and rivers. None of that. It's simply there's no individuals there. We are not there. When you reach moksha, you're no longer, it's not you who reaches moksha. You come out of this illusion that there's a you. You no longer exist as an individual. You merge back into this infinite oneness. It's not that I finally made it. There's no I that makes it. You leave behind all this baggage of thinking that you're a separate person. You have no triumph that Mrs. Bennett is looking for. You can't look down. I made it and everybody else is waiting. There's no you. You have left it all behind. You simply go back to oneness. And from that perspective, Shankara's view, his is a supracosmic view, this is not really real. We think we are in a world. It's really a dream. It's more like a hallucination. So the goal is to wake up from this hallucination that we're all separate people with separate lives and that it's important what we do and what we think. We simply have to get out. So he's very clear about what's the aim of life. The aim of life is to get out of life. The aim of life, why ever we're here, let's not ask that question. We can't understand that mystery. That's the mystery of Maya. The aim of life is to wake up from the dream. And what do you get when you wake up from the dream? Bliss. Some formless, indescribable bliss. Anyway, you don't have any problems after that. That you can be sure. Nothing to worry about. No exams, no fees, no health problems or anything else. You're just in eternal bliss. Or rather, the bliss is there. You're not there anymore. It's over. There are extreme forms of the supracosmic view. Buddha is also of the supracosmic view. Buddha says, life is not unreal, but it's a world of suffering. It's a wheel of suffering. He doesn't promise us that you go to moksha and you live in an eternal infinite bliss. He says you get out of the suffering. You go to nirvana. What is nirvana? He calls it a void. A void. Who wants to get out of life and go to a void? No, that's, you don't have any problems there. As long as you're here, you're trapped on the wheel of karma. You're caught by the dualities. You're going to be constantly tricked. For every enjoyment you have, there's going to be something to prick you and hurt you later. For every success you have, there'll be a failure. As good as you want to be, evil will be there. For all the beauty, there'll be ugliness. There's no escape from this. You better go to nirvana. But anyway, that nirvana is really not such a bad place. It's very peaceful and eternal happiness. Who's going to be happy? I can't say anybody's going to be happy because there's nobody there. But it's happiness. You'll be in the happiness. Now, there are other views of the supracosmic, other versions of this story. There's more than one version. And Sri Aurobindo points out that in the Upanishads, They also say that there's a truth to the becoming. He says in one chapter, several places, the Upanishads not only affirms the fact that there is only one, and that is the Brahman, it also affirms the fact that all is Brahman. This man, this tree, that bird, the grass, everything in the world is also Brahman. So there are views in which the exact relationship between the cosmic and the supracosmic is not very clear, but all of the views tell us that the goal is to get from here to there. None of them really tell us why we're here or why we ever ended up here or why there should be a here or why there ever should have been a world in the first place if the goal is only to get out of it. But they say that's a super-rational mystery and we can't understand it and there's no way to know it. Better not to struggle and bother ourselves with that. We know where we belong, so let's just forget it. It's a maya, it's a mystery. Just wake up from the dream and get to the... So the aim of life is to get out of life. That's the supra-cosmic view. Get out of the universe. Then there's the supra-terrestrial view. I hope it's clear. Supra-cosmic is beyond all universe. Supra-terrestrial is beyond the earth. That is, beyond this plane in which we live, the mind, life, and the body. The heaven. That is, there's a heavens above. There are other worlds above. And according to the supra-terrestrial view, we're here on earth to get to heaven. Again, it raises all kinds of questions as to why on earth did we end up on earth if the purpose is to get to heaven? Who put us here? And how do we get to heaven? And how do we qualify for heaven? And there are all different variations on that. In Christianity, God has created us, put us on earth, and is putting us through a test. And according to how we perform on that test, we either end up in heaven or we end up in hell. That's also supra-terrestrial. There's a supra-terrestrial hell. Why he did this, why he created us, why he gave us the temperaments and wonderful personalities we have, and why he's decided that for what we do in these few minutes of our life, we're going to either suffer or enjoy for eternity. Well, it raises a number of questions, but that's God's work. But anyway, that's clearly a view where the goal of life is to get to heaven. And everything for the Christian that we do on earth is to qualify us for heaven. So the Protestants do good works. They believe in working very hard. It's called the Protestant ethic because God likes people who work hard. The Catholics are very particular about not doing anything wrong because God doesn't so much worry about what you do right, but as what you do wrong, he counts very strongly on the scorecard. Every error counts against you, every lie and every sin. And by the way, we're all born with sin, with an original sin. If it's an original sin, obviously it couldn't be our fault because it was originally before us. But anyway, if we express that original sin with which we're born, we go to the other place. But the clear, regardless of what the religion is, the idea is, the aim is only to do something here that will get us to heaven. And Yudhishthira seemed to me to fall in that category. Of course, he's a very noble, admirable person, but fundamentally, he's not thinking of moksha. He's not thinking of dissolving in the infinite. He's thinking of qualifying himself by his good deeds of dharma for an eternity in the higher heaven with the gods. And so what he does on earth, whether he loses his kingdom, whether he loses a war, whether he goes into poverty, whatever it is, if it brings him to heaven, he has done the best he can do. This is the supra-terrestrial view. I think it's pretty clear. It should be pretty clear. Now there's the cosmic terrestrial view. Let's call it the Earth view, because these are long words, and that we won't confuse the terrestrials and supras. The Earth view. The Earth view is the opposite of the supracosmic view. The supracosmic view says the only thing that's really real is the spirit, is the oneness. Not heaven, is the one. The only thing that's really real is the one. And the Earth's view, the materialist view, is the only thing that's really real is what's there before you. What you can taste, what you can touch, what you can feel, what you can see and hear. This is reality. Don't get mistaken. Don't get carried away by any philosophy or all these stories that people tell you or these hallucinations they have. This is reality. This is it. This is all we have. Don't think about the heaven above or some eternal bliss in moksha. The only thing you can really have is here, so you better make the most of it. This is the Earth view, the materialist view, the terrestrial view. It's the opposite. So it says the only real reality is the cosmic existence, and by cosmic existence we really mean the material existence, not some heavenly world which the scientist can't find and measure or see in the telescope. And according to this view, we're the highest being that exists, leave alone God. We have come out of the earth, we've come out of matter, we've evolved, and we are the best there is, as far as we know. There may be some monsters or superior beings on other planets. We don't know about them. But right here, we are the peak of existence. There's nothing beyond us. And when we look back, we seem to be pretty similar to the people that were here 5,000 years ago. So it doesn't look like we're changing. Of course, our technology's improving, our cities are getting there, we're spoiling the air with all our machinery and everything, but human being pretty much remains what he was. So there's nothing beyond the human. There's no soul. In the supraterrestrial view, the soul is real, because when we give up the life, we don't disappear. The soul goes to heaven. In the supracosmic view, the soul doesn't go to moksha. The soul itself dissolves when it reaches moksha. In the supraterrestrial view, the soul lives eternally in heaven or that other place. But here, there's no soul. In the cosmic view, we are what you see. We are the body, we are the life, the vital, we are the mind. This is all we have. We better make the most of them. And they're not going to change, they're not going to be transformed into something else. So the goal must be to make the most of what we are, to satisfy our material needs, our vital desires, our mental curiosity and interests. And of course, we may have different variations on that. Some of us may think, like Lydia, that just enjoying ourselves is important, or like Mr. Hurst, to sleep on the sofa as much as possible and not be disturbed. That's very physical. Lydia is a little more vital. Mrs. Bennett really lives in the vital. She's wanting to dominate other people. Without other people, there's no life for her. Or somebody may be mental. Somebody may be curious, want to learn, want to write books or compose ideas and philosophies and all. But whatever that is, whatever you really feel like doing, you might as well do it, because there's nothing else there. It has many versions, but the ultimate version is the really extreme version. If Shankara and Buddha are at one end of the
thing. At the other end of the thing, you have the scientist. I mean, the scientist, as science says, I don't know that all scientists really live this way, but if you really see what the scientist today says, there's only one thing that exists, it's matter. Even your thoughts are only chemical and electrical impulses. Your emotions and love are really only chemical hormones. There's no such thing as love. There's a hormone that makes you feel a little warm in the heart region or something like that. They reduce it to really basic. There's only matter. We think we're thinking, but it's only a computer discharging electrical circuits and things. We think we're loving, but it's only hormones and chemicals that make us like some people and fight with others and all of that. It's an extreme view. So these are the three views which pretty well characterize all of the main theories that have been the basis for civilization up until now. And the fourth view, he calls the integral or the synthetic view. And this is a very important thing. The theory we believe in determines the aim of life. This is not philosophy. What we believe is really the reality, not what we say. What we believe is really the reality determines the aim of our life. For Lydia, the reality is the intensity in her nerves. Nothing else is real. See, even after eloping with Wickham and coming back in disgrace, she's not even embarrassed what other people will say. Society is not real to her. Her reputation is not real to her. It doesn't exist. What reputation? What society? Who cares what that? I did what I wanted to do. I had the excitement. I had the thrill. I got Wickham. Lizzie wanted Wickham. I got Wickham. It's the thrill. It's the intensity. So this is very important for us to examine and really see what's real to us. Not what philosophy we've accepted. Oh, I'm a devotee of Sri Aurobindo. I believe in life divine. I sleep with it under my pillow. And not that. What do I really believe is real? What's really real to me in my nerves, in my mind, in my emotions? That's going to determine how I live. Well, what does he tell us? What does Sri Aurobindo say? He says, they're all right. The terrestrial view, the supra-terrestrial view, and the supra-cosmic view are all true. They're all right. But they're each a partial truth. Each of them is true, but each of them is a part of the truth. And this is one of the lines in the chapter I like the most. What does Sri Aurobindo mean by truth? Because how to define truth? He says, truth is that view in which there are no contradictions. Now, normally when I ask or think about what's true, I mean what's the opposite of what's false. If I say I'm right, I mean that you're wrong. He says, the real truth is something to which there are no contradictions. If I'm really in truth, I can't disagree with anybody. Even if you all have different views, if I really know the truth, the only thing I can do is I can see the relative partial truth of every other view. None of this, no. You may be right and you're partly right, but you three are all wrong. That's not true.
That which is true recognizes the truth in everything. There is nothing without truth in it. The real truth is that which can harmonize and integrate and synthesize all views which look to be contradictory to each other. Now, that's not a very convenient formula for truth, because we can never win any argument. Because whatever anybody says, any viewpoint that anybody says, if I really want to be in truth, I have to appreciate their point of view. Ultimately, I would like to be able to say, okay, you make some sense and all, but after all, I was right, right? What's the idea of going around and spending all of your time appreciating that everybody who disagrees with you on everything is right? But Sri Aurobindo says if we're really in the truth, that's what it will be. We'll be there. So I didn't come here to appreciate everybody else. I would like somebody to appreciate me. Somebody should recognize that I know the truth of something. The truth is I be in the true consciousness only when I see the truth in what everybody says, even when it's diametrically opposite to what I believe. I can't quarrel with anybody. I can't feel superior to anybody. I can only appreciate an infinite variety of truths. What a conception. I don't think it exists anywhere in the world other than Sri Aurobindo. Every religion, every philosophy starts out by saying these are the things that are right and these are the things that are wrong. And the moment you have a other side to the equation, you know it's a partial truth. In the integral knowledge, in the integral yoga, there's only one equation. It includes everything. It shows, it doesn't just include everything, it shows everything in its proper place in a greater whole. So though it would be nice to say the supracosmic view is wrong and the supraterrestrial view is wrong and the terrestrial view is wrong and we can feel superior because we don't fit into any of those categories, Sri Aurobindo says we have to appreciate the truth in each of these other views, because only when we fully recognize and honor the truth in all of them, we can be in the truth. Whereas each of them has started out by denying the truth of the others. Shankara says all this is an illusion. The materialist says everything else is an illusion that isn't that you can't touch and feel or measure with your or see in your telescope or your microscope. So that which excludes can never be the full truth. It's a very fascinating idea, very practical, but very annoying if you try to practice it. Very demanding, let's say. So in the real truth, all contradictions are reconciled because they are all revealed as complementary aspects of something that's greater, that includes all of them, that is founded on unity and oneness. That's why he said, in chapter 1, without explaining all of this, that's why he said in chapter 1, contradictions are complements. It's by definition. Why should it be true that contradictions are complements? Anybody? Why must it, how can he say that? He may say that these two contradictions are complements, but what about those? How can he so surely assert that all contradictions are complements? There's no, why? Why? That's what he says, but how does he know for sure? How can you say for sure? There's a, how can there be a partial truth in everything? Agree, but how? How can that be? Go back to the original formula of reality that we just discussed. because there's only one. Because there's only one, and everything, the being and the becoming, the Satchitananda, the seven planes, the personal and the impersonal, our only aspect, the God, the cosmos, and the individual, they're only aspects of one. There's nothing beyond that. So every partial truth is an expression of some aspect of this one. But the truth is the one. The whole truth is the one. It includes the unmanifest, which is the supracosmic view. It has to include the being. It includes the becoming, which is the terrestrial view. It includes all the planes in between. It's a fascinating thought. This one thought, if you, how to recognize every contradiction as a compliment. In practice, this is very practical, because we want to be practical. If you recognize everybody's truth, it seems very impractical. But actually, he says, as long as you insist on a partial truth, you run into trouble. Sooner or later, you run into a wall. You may have a formula that works for you. It will work. No, as a devotee, I should follow this rule and I should only do this thing. Up to a certain level, it will work for us. And beyond a certain level, you find out you're confronted with a reality you can't handle because we're working on a partial truth. All our formulas are a partial truth. He says it's impossible for man to guide his life permanently or wholly by any of these motives, whether it's the supracosmic or the supraterrestrial or the terrestrial. Now we have to think, what is the significance? See, Darcy wanted to function according to his social prestige, his pride. And he lived his life like that for 27 years. Self-importance, superiority, distance from other people, pride, he lived. And he thought that was the formula for his whole life. And then he met Elizabeth. And suddenly all of this becomes very relative, and he discovers there's a whole other side to the truth. There's love. Whatever her class may be, whatever her family may be, whatever her mother or her sister may be, she's an individual. I want her. I need her. I can't live without her. He came face to face with an aspect of reality that he had denied, that he had ignored. So any partial truth ultimately hits a wall where you can't go further, where you can't deal with it further. So wherever we reach a problem that we can't solve, we should know that the truth we're living by is partial. We have to broaden that truth and come closer to the reality of what Sri Aurobindo and Mother are really saying. It's a very interesting idea. In fact, isn't that what life is all about for us? Life is constantly presenting us with things that are outside our formula for truth, that are contradictions of our formula for truth. No, I said I will only do this, and now I have to do that. We should only do it this way, but now I have to adjust with that way. This is not right. This is not possible. This person should be suffering because they're doing the opposite of what I believe to be true, and that they're thriving. Our whole life is confronted by apparent contradictions, which are there. Not like Lady Catherine, who's trying to protect herself from the world, to help us come out of our box, shed our limitations, and discover a greater truth. Because the supramental truth, Sri Aurobindo's truth, the truth that Mother is talking about, is not limited by any formulation. That's why Mother said, If people want to make Sri Aurobindo into another religion, she said, if it becomes another religion, I'd be the first one to leave. Because the world doesn't need any more religions that divide themselves off and say, this is the truth and yours is not the truth. We need something that doesn't have, isn't the opposite of anybody else. When we look practically, we have to recognize there is a truth in the terrestrial view. After all, we spend most of our life and our energy on Earth, taking care of ourselves, our care of our health, our body, our needs, our desires, living in our family, living in community, building our cities, governing our nation. It can't be that all of this activity is completely a waste of time and has no meaning. There must be a meaning in it. There must be a purpose in it. We can't deny, as the supraterrestrial or the supracosmic view denies, any real meaning to life on Earth. There is a meaning here. The question is, what is that meaning and how do we draw the most out of that meaning? God has given us senses, given us emotions, given us a mind to think. There must be something we're to do with that other than just prepare ourselves to get out, to escape from it. So what should we be doing with it? After all, if none of this matters, why should I exercise? Why should I worry about my health? Why should I worry about my relations with other people? Why should I educate my mind and all? That's all irrelevant if the purpose is to get out. But there seems to be some meaning here. We're all spending so much time worrying about our health, worrying about our relationships, trying to develop our mind, trying to learn things, trying to educate ourselves, trying to do things properly here. It must have some meaning. So there's a truth in the terrestrial view. But it's a partial truth. After all, there are people who spend their whole life only worrying about their health. The fitness addict. Every day he spends 5 hours, 6 hours exercising, and then he goes and eats healthy food, and the next day he goes and exercises. And what are you doing this for? Oh, I'm taking care of my health. And why are you taking care of your health? So I can live longer. And what are you going to do when you're going to live longer? I'm going to take care of my health for a longer period of time. Taking care of your health is good, but it's not an end in itself. Living is not an end in itself. Mother said, there was a sign she put in the ashram dining room, which I saw back in 1971. Eat for living, do not live for eating. Eating is necessary. But there are people for whom eating is the goal in itself. At the end of the meal, only 3 more hours, and then I get to go again. Eating is definitely necessary. It serves a purpose, but it can't be the ultimate purpose. There must be something beyond that. Developing the mind, education. Oh, I'm getting all of this knowledge. What are you going to do next year? I'm going to read more books. I'm going to get more knowledge. And then what are you going to do? Oh, and after that, I'm going to read more books. And what are you going to do with this knowledge? What's going to happen when you die? It's going to all be gone. There must be something beyond the accumulation of knowledge, even if you become an expert on any topic. Even if I could memorize life divine, what is the purpose of it? So there's a validity. There is a purpose in what we do on Earth. But we have to discover what that purpose really is. He says, we also have a sense that there's something more than this. Most of us have that sense. Even scientists have that sense, though they may not. That there's got to be more than this. There's got to be more than living and eating and reading and studying and dressing and all of this. Life has to have more meaning than that. We hope it does, and there are people who have a very strong feeling that it does. More than that, I just can't believe that I have come here suddenly out of nowhere, and after a certain number of years, it's over. That sense of continuity, that sense that there's something in us that survives death, that there's something in us that was here before we were born and will exist after our birth, that intuition of a soul has been there for thousands of years in every country, all over the world, not just in one place or another. That sense that the individual is not limited to a physical body and a one-time life, and it's all over after that. And there are many people who have reported experiences, near-death experiences, and others. And anyone, if you've read Mother's Agenda, and she talks about, she says, Satpreme is asking her, what's the difference between those that are alive and those who are dead and have left the body? She says, not much. Not much. She says, I'm trying to find out exactly what that difference is, but they're both there, all around her. So every tradition has discovered that there is a soul that is immortal, at least if it's not immortal, it long out lives the body. So what we do here is relevant not just to our immediate enjoyment or our satisfaction, our security. What we do here has some relevance to what happens afterwards. So we need something that not only to enjoy this, we need to do something that will give us the maximum preparation for what goes beyond this. So there's a truth in the superterrestrial view. And then he says, we develop mentally, culturally, emotionally, we get the perception that both the world as we know it, the material world, and even the higher heavens is not the ultimate truth of things. Even a world of gods is not the ultimate reality. There's got to be something, there is something. There is something beyond even the gods, which is the source of all, which is the source of their creative, which is the source even of the heavens and all. There is a supracosmic reality that has manifested itself. It is the origin. It is the ultimate truth behind everything. And ultimately, our destiny must be to find that reality and its significance and why it has created us, or rather, why it has become us. And unless we discover that, we are not fully fulfilling the aim of our life here, because he tells us the aim of our life here is to discover why that has created the universe and why it has become each of us, and what is our destiny as individuals in that. So it's not an either or, it's how do we relate our material existence, the supraterrestrial planes, and the supracosmic reality, and how do they relate to one another? How do we synthesize them? This is the real question. And then he says, a perfect equation, a perfect formula. It looks like they're incompatible, and all of the traditions have taken it that way. You either are a materialist, or you're an Advaita, or you're believing in some heavens above, and it's either one or the other. How do you reconcile these apparently contradictory views of reality? How do we find out the key to their unity, as well as their difference, and the part that each plays in the puzzle, in the mystery of the universe? That's what we need to find. That's what this book is all about. And he says, The solution is a synthesis. It's an integration. And we're going to talk about, he uses the word integration in a way, in its proper way, but in, I have not found this concept anywhere else. The word is commonly used in different fields, but I don't think anybody has ever conceived of the word integration the way he conceives of it, and we'll come back to it. He says the synthesis we want is not a compromise. It's not, we'll do a little of this, well, we'll have a little joy, and we'll have a little study, and we'll take a little time for exercise, like I do, or we'll have a little time for reading, and then we'll pray for a little while. And it's not a compromise where we try to do everything. That's not an integration. That's not a synthesis. That's a masala. We put everything in there. He says the key to this synthesis is an evolution. I missed this for a long time because he says it in an earlier chapter. He said the whole key to the puzzle of the universe is evolution. I said that's, yes, we know we're evolving. He's been telling us we're evolving. It's very simple. Why doesn't everybody know that the key is evolution? But I never understood what he meant by it. Only in this chapter I understood. The solution to this puzzle is not in the present. There's no way to put these four pieces together and solve this puzzle in the present. The solution lies in the future. Rather, the solution lies in an evolution of consciousness. There's no way we can try to knock our heads together instead of blaming Shankara for missing, not solving the puzzle, or the Christians or anybody else for not solving the puzzle. They couldn't solve the puzzle because the puzzle can't be solved in the present. The puzzle can only be solved when we evolve. And there was no conception. The Vedanta understood that we have evolved from the plant and the animal to the human. But that was, he says in chapter one, the conception was that man, human beings, are the last step in the evolution. And Sri Aurobindo says, if human beings are the last step in the evolution, there's no solution. There is no reconciliation possible. But fortunately for us, we are not the last step in the evolution. It's inevitable that that which is involved is going to evolve. And the solution to the puzzle and the reconciliation of these apparent contradictions lies in the evolution of consciousness. And therefore, our purpose here, how can we reconcile this? I have to do a little exercise, a little eating, a little reading, and a little of praying, and all of these things. The answer to this is not all of these things. I have to evolve. I have to evolve in my consciousness. I have to evolve to the point in which all the pieces of the puzzle fit together. And that's what we need to find out. That's the secret for us. How can I find out whether I'm eating or sleeping or talking or working or reading or doing anything? How do I find out how this activity serves my evolution of my consciousness so I am working towards the ultimate aim of the cosmos, of the divine, and of my own soul? And that's the secret for the reconciliation. We see that development is the law of our human being. We have evolved. We came out of the forest. We came off of the land. We have developed cities. We've developed technologies. We've developed cultures, civilizations, so many things. We've been developing. Only thing is, somehow we thought that it's over. We have somehow reached the limit, when we're really just warming up the main show. He says, there's only one society that really has attempted a synthetic solution. it was ancient India. All the others have attempted partial solutions, but this knowledge, this intuitive knowledge that there's a truth in each of these views was there in the ancient tradition. It was a partial effort, but it was a great effort. They recognized that there's a truth and legitimacy in our physical needs and interests, in our vital desires, in our ethical and religious aspirations, and in our spiritual quest. One is the claim or urge of our physical, one is of the vital and the emotional, one is of the mental, the other is of our spiritual being or our soul. All are legitimate, all have a place. And they tried to find a way to reconcile them. And so they created the four stages, the varnas, four periods of life where a period of where we're preparing for life, where we're getting educated, a period of which we're as a householder where we're normally enjoying the satisfactions of life, where we're trying to live by ethical and religious principles, a period in which we gradually withdraw and concentrate more and more on spiritual truths, and finally the sannyasi, when we give up everything and go off. This idea didn't work very well in its simple form, because not everybody can go through these four stages in their life. Maybe I have to spend the whole life as a householder or as a student. Very few are ready even to turn towards spiritual things, let alone sannyasi, which is very rare. So they came with the conception that this is not something to be done in one life. The soul is continuously reborn. In each life, you move through this process and you became capable of moving up the stages so that the physical takes less importance and the spiritual takes increasing importance as the soul evolves. This was an ingenious attempt at a synthesis. He says ultimately it failed. Ultimately, it collapsed because it didn't really have the essential key, but it was a great attempt. When it collapsed, it broke into two halves. One half are the people who are living the normal life. They're the devotees who are going to the temples and practicing the normal religion. The other are the sannyasis who are renouncing everything and going to the forest. But notice, they're irreconcilable. They're two irreconcilable halves. They don't lead to an ultimate synthesis. So the attempt at synthesis broke down because the truth on which it was based was partial. But it was a great attempt and a signal towards which we should go. So what do we see about the partial views? The terrestrial view misses the fulfillment of spiritual consciousness in life. This is real, but what is real? Food is real. Bed is real. Car is real. Status is real. All that the characters are following in the story is real. Love is not really a terrestrial aim. Charlotte is the materialist. She wants security. Carolyn is the materialist. She wants status. But when Darcy's willing to give up his money for love, and Mr. Bennett's willing to bend over backwards for something non-existent to the materialist, honor. If you ask the materialist about honor, he'll say it's a chemical hormone. It's some chemical. We haven't discovered the chemical for honor yet, but don't get too serious about it. We'll give you an injection and you'll have all the honor you want. Because he's a materialist. So the materialist misses the spiritual significance of life. And any sincere scientist who really quests for the truth or really wants to do something that will contribute to humanity, whatever his thought beliefs are, he's really not a materialist. If you really care about helping humanity, you can't be just a materialist, because we are all just matter. We don't worry about the stones. We don't worry about the trees. Why should you worry about other people if it's really just materialist? So it's a partial view, and I think we know it would deprive us of the most valuable thing we have. Sri Aurobindo said, if you're a real materialist, then the piece of marble or mud pie or a dosa or a plum pudding or whatever it is more real to you than the highest ideal, than the greatest work of art, than the most beautiful poem, than the most noble deed. We can't reduce our whole life to that. Certainly you can't tell Darcy that his house and his money and his status are more important than his love for Elizabeth. He's not a materialist. He may have started out thinking he was a materialist, but by the end of the story, he was convinced there's something much more to life. And he said, oh, if I hadn't met Elizabeth, I would have missed everything. I would have led a meaningless life because I thought status was important, prestige was important, my tradition was important. I would have missed the essence. The supracosmic view, it also misses the whole universe. It marginalizes the value of the whole cosmos which the divine has become and created and everything in it. It can't have the satisfaction of a total truth. It may be very peaceful, quiet, and even blissful. But what about the bliss of creation? What about the delight of self-discovery? What about the adventure and courage and mystery of constant unfolding and creativity? These two are divine. It would be a very colorless bliss if it wasn't for the universe there also. And the supraterrestrial view, you know, the idea we should get to heaven and get out of here as quick as possible, it misses on both sides. It misses that there's any valid purpose to be on earth except to get to heaven. And when you get to heaven, you miss the ultimate goal, which is the divine oneness. You're still separate from everybody else. You're still separate from the divine. You never discover the oneness. You never discover the secret of the universe. So even though they are all true, they're all partial truths. So he says, spiritual evolution is the key. It's the link for reconciling our life on earth, our conscious mentality, with spirit. And that is the synthesis that he's working on. Evolution tells us the world we live in and the life we live cannot be fulfilled unless it's transformed by the higher. Our life on earth will really have its meaning only when it becomes spiritualized. See the difference? Not only when we get out of it and go to the spirit. That's not what he says. Only when the spirit comes here. That's escape. This is integration. Only when we're able to marry life on earth with the spirit, meaning only when we're able to make life on earth spiritual and everything in our life spiritual, can our material life have its full meaning. That's the fulfillment for the material universe, why it was created. It was created not as a passageway to heaven or something to escape from it. It was created as a place that should become divine. its ultimate destiny is to be a life divine, manifesting the divine in the material universe. That's why it's created. That's its ultimate fulfillment. But he also says the higher, the supraterrestrial, rather the supracosmic, it can't be fully fulfilled as long as it's forced to live up there. As long as it has to take recluse in the heavens or beyond the heavens, and only the only bliss and peace is up there in moksha, the only happiness is in the heavens, he's confined to the library like Mr. Bennett. Only place he can find his joy and his peace and quiet is in the library. No. That's the fulfillment. The fulfillment for the spirit is when it can enjoy itself everywhere. It can manifest itself everywhere. Only when Mr. Bennett can be in the living room, he can be out, he can go anywhere and be happy and peaceful and joyous, is he really a master? Does he really have mastery and fullness in life? Just to hide in the library reading his books can't be the ultimate aim of things. So for the spirit also to say that God has to remain in heaven, or he can't manifest, he can't become a universe, and if he creates a universe, it'll be a mess, full of suffering and everything, is to say this is a pretty limited God. He can only create evil, he can only create ignorance and suffering, and he can't create beauty and joy, and it doesn't make sense. So the fulfillment for the being is when it can fully manifest itself in the becoming. See, fulfillment for the earth by receiving the spirit, fulfillment for the spirit by manifesting in matter, in the material life on earth. There's the reconciliation, there's the integration. And that's what hasn't happened so far. We've had the material life, we've had the people living to get to heaven, and we've had a few great souls going to moksha, but they're all three different compartments. How do we integrate them? How do we bring this so that we really see the ultimate aim for all of us? The infinite must be able to express itself in the finite, otherwise it's not infinite. The divine must be able to be divine in life, otherwise it's a very limited, impotent divine. It's not the ultimate power in the universe if it can't overtake the evil of life. So the evolution of our consciousness is what will help us reconcile these three goals as one. And that's the synthesis. He says our mortality is justified only in the light of our immortality. There's no meaning to our life. There can be no real fulfillment in our life if the truth is not that we are really immortal souls. What does it matter that I live in Pemberley, or that I am more important than somebody else, or that I have a high status like Lady Catherine, or I can look down on people like Darcy, if at the end of 30 or 70 or 90 or 100 years, it's all over and we're all dust? Then what's the meaning of that? It's a very unsatisfactory, temporary satisfaction. Our mortality, and what does it matter? This matters because the effort we take here, the life we are living here, is not a temporary thing. We are preparing to manifest our ultimate spiritual destiny. We're on an immortal quest, and every step of the way, nothing is lost. He says no forward step is ever lost. No upward aspiration is ever lost. Everything we do counts, whether in this life or in another life, whether it counts as a monetary success or because we become a better person, or because we discover a greater truth, or we sense more of mother. Everything we do matters because it's the quest of an immortal soul, not only for a temporary enjoyment here, but for a spiritual realization. But we can fully know ourselves and we can fully understand ourselves only when we know the real truth of ourselves is the supreme. It's not the ego. It's not that I am living for myself. I'm living for my vanity, my pride, my importance, my satisfaction. We can really know our destiny and our value only when we know that it is the divine that's trying to express in us and through us in life. And our destiny is to express the divine delight, the divine knowledge, the divine powers, the divine consciousness in the world. So the meaning of our life, the meaning of our individuality, and the meaning of the divine are not three different things. The divine has become us. The divine has become the world because it wants to manifest in the world, and it wants to manifest in the world through us, which is it, which are its forms. It is the divine trying to unfold itself in the life of each of us. Then our aim is not to triumph over Lady Lucas or to rise like Collins to another class and have a better patroness. Our aim must be to manifest the spirit that's trying to express in us, that has taken form in our soul, that has created a whole world as a theater and a field of our experience for that evolution. So he says his view, a realized unity, a unity of the transcendent, the universal, and the individual, is the essential condition for the full self-expression of the spirit, which is the aim of life, which is the aim of the universe, which is the aim of existence, which is the aim of the absolute. There's only one aim. There's only one true aim. The aim of our lives, the aim of life on earth, the aim of this universe, and the aim of the absolute, are the true aim, are only one. It is the manifestation of the spirit in its fullness, in its perfection, in its infinite multiplicity. And anything else we do, or anything we do on the way, is valid in the measure it helps us move towards that fulfillment. Obviously, we need to take care of the body, because the body is the field. It's the material base for that. It's not an unembodied spirit that's trying to... The matter has been created so that the spirit can manifest in matter. The spirit has become individual souls so that it can manifest its diversity. Our individuality matters. It matters tremendously. We're not all alike. We're not all to be the same color or the same size or anything. We are each uniquely, spiritually an individual. That matters. Darcy's love, Mr. Bennett's highest value of honor. Every aspiration has a truth behind it that can be, that should be honored, because it's a truth of the spirit trying to emerge. So he says, Earth is the field of an evolutionary integration. Notice the difference. Earth is not the thing we should escape from. Earth is not just the transing, a passing place so we can get to heaven. Earth is not a passage to something. Earth is the destination. But not the earth we live in today. The earth that's evolving. The life that's evolving to a divine life. The divinity is not to be just found up there. We have to find it up there. We have to bring it down here and realize it here. Earth is the field for an evolutionary integration. The material world and human life are a part of the spirit's self-expression and their divine possibility.
It's an evolutionary possibility, means we have to evolve towards that fulfillment. And it contains, and this was a new thought for me, I had missed it up until now, it contains the possibilities of all the other worlds. I never really understood if there's a one up there and we got the earth down here, why do we need all of these planes in between? He says that each of the other worlds, they're typal worlds, they're not evolutionary worlds. The gods are real. The gods are there in supramental heavens, and there are vital beings in vital heavens and mental beings. There are so many typal beings that are there, all of each of which expresses some potentiality of the divine. But the difference is, those beings are not evolving beings. Those beings are fixed expressions of a possibility or a capacity, whether it's a beauty or love or joy or power or whatever it is. They can't integrate. They can only represent a particular power. The human evolving being, the soul on earth, has the capacity to receive all of these powers into us. We have that capacity to receive all those powers into our being and to integrate them and manifest them. And if you go back to the early Rig Veda, in the Rig Veda, the rishis, they're not praying to go to heaven. They're calling on the gods to come and descend into them with their light, with their power, with their ananda, with all their inspiration and all their divine capacities. The sacrifice is the spiritual, the inner call and the inner aspiration for all the gods to come and descend into the human being and transform it. They had that conception. So this is the only place where that can happen. This is the only place where that realization can happen. And what means when we become divine, it means all the powers and potentialities of the higher planes, the beauty of the higher heavens, the power of the gods, the knowledge of the greatest mental planes and over-mental planes, all of that comes here and expresses through the individuality and the collectivity of the supramental being on earth. It is the true integration. So when he uses the word integration, he means something very different than fitting a few pieces of the puzzle together. He means making the oneness real in life. And it defies words, it defies expression, but I tried in preparing to think about the very many ways in which he's talking about this integration. The one, of course, is a unity, but the one has become an infinite multiplicity. How does it integrate itself? It integrates itself in an infinite number of different ways. So even to write 5 or 10 of them is to make it sound like it's limited. It's not limited, but it gives you some idea. First of all, we have to discover in our own life the truth that the individual, the universal, and the transcendent are the same being. I don't know about you, but I'm not there. To me, you're all separate. To me, the world is separate. To me, the divine is separate. Imagine that you will wake up every minute and know every moment that you are in everyone else, and you are the universe, and you are an expression of the transcendent divine. And that's why Sri Aurobindo says, why do you want to worship God when your destiny is to become God? Of course, when the ego thinks of becoming God, it's like Lady Catherine, so it can rule over everybody else. But everybody's God. There's nobody to rule over. And there's not everybody else. There's one God. expressing in an infinite variety of beings. That's the integration of our individuality, our universality, and the transcendence. It's a unique conception. He also talks about the integration of mind, life, matter, supermind, Satchitananda. They're all spirit. When he talks about the supramental being, he's talking about discovering that matter is Satchitananda, life is Satchitananda, mind is Satchitananda. The spirit expresses in everything. There are no longer seven planes. There are seven powers all manifesting. Now we see them as separate. This is inanimate. Some plants and animals are life. We are mentally conscious beings, and there's something above us. But they're all separate. But to discover them all as expressions of the spirit, and the supermind expressing in our mind, in our emotions, and even in our material bodies, is an integration which is inconceivable. But that's our destiny. He says it's an integration of being and becoming. We no longer have to go to the being by moksha to know the absolute. We will know the absolute in the world, in the world. He had that supramental experience in Alipur jail. When he saw the jailers as Satchitananda, as Krishna, he saw the bars, the prison, the trees, everything. This was not the vision that Arjuna had of Krishna. This was a vision where everything is the divine. Everything is Satchitananda. That is the integration of the being and the becoming. The integration of the one and the many. Our individuality is true. We're not going to ultimately find out it was an illusion. Our individuality is true, but it's a true individuality of the one. We are each a true, unique expression of the one, of the same one. We are each one as well as the many. And the two are not separate, the two are integrated. The form and the formless. We will discover as that the jewels and the spoon and the plate and everything are gold, we will discover that every form is a form of spirit. We will know everything as spirit. We will know everything as divine. There'll no longer be a division between the finite and the infinite. We will know that everything that is finite is really an expression of the infinite. Every moment is infinite with potential. Every person is infinite with possibilities. Every situation is capable of anything that we decide, of becoming anything that we want to become, of doing anything we want to do, because it's the infinite. Every finite is the infinite. This idea that there's an involution from spirit to matter and a gradual evolution, they're two separate things or two in a sequence, we will come to the point, he says, the involution is simply the divine, the spirit taking form, and the evolution is the form revealing itself as spirit. And when we know ourselves and everything around us as form of spirit, the involution and evolution are simultaneous. We will be the form. We will be conscious of the essence. Now we have become the form and lost the essence. We hope to discover the essence, but those who discovered the essence lost the truth of the form. They had to give up everything for that. We will know the form is the essence. We will know the simultaneously in time. It will be simultaneous time, not in a sequence of time. We don't have to wait for the discovery.
He will integrate the highest superconscient heavens with the inconscience below, which is the role of the human being to make the spirit reveal the superconscient in the inconscient, reveal the supermind in the inconscient, reveal the fact that everything we think is inanimate, that's happening by chance without any explanation or apparent purpose, has a meaning behind it. Because there's a plan behind it, there's an intention behind it, there's the spirit behind it. The time and timeless will be integrated. We will be in that dual consciousness where we can enjoy the play in time, and yet we will be simultaneously aware of that which is timeless and eternal. We will never think that anything can be lost, because we will know at every minute that we are here for eternity. Nothing can be lost. All exists. We reconcile the individuality of the ego. Of course, it won't be the ego then, it'll be the spiritual individual. But the soul in the depths and the ego on the surface will be integrated in what he calls the spiritual individual. We will be the individual, but we won't be the egoistic individual. We'll be the spiritual individual. And finally, not finally in his terms, finally on my short list, we will integrate all the dualities, and most of all the duality that there's good in the world and there's evil in the world, will be reconciled, because there is no real good or evil. There are only expressions of various expressions moving us in evolution towards a greater good. We will cease to have a vision, and we will cease to have anything that can resemble what we now see as evil. It will no longer have any purpose. It will no longer exist. So when he talks about integration, he really means an integration that doesn't leave out anything, that doesn't exclude anything, that has no opposite, that has no wrong side. So, we're getting to the conclusion. There is an all-seeing purpose in the terrestrial creation. A divine plan is working itself out through its contradictions and perplexities. The idea is not to get away from the contradictions. The contradictions are presenting us with the truth that we miss, with the truth we've excluded. The contradictions are the source of our greater truth. We need to embrace them and learn from them. Our soul's growth and nature's evolution are being led towards a many-sided achievement, not a narrow achievement like go to heaven or go to moksha, something much grander than that. The whole infinite is coming here. The whole infinite is coming here to manifest, and we are the prelude and preparation for that infinite manifestation. There are three stages in the cycle of this self-progression of the spirit. It's not our self-progression, notice. We are the ego. It's the spirit that's self-progressing through us. First, there's an involution in the inconscient. That was the beginning, when we forgot everything. We lost all contact with the real reality and intention. Then there's an evolution in the ignorance. That's us. We've been talking about it for a while. We are the inconscient waking up and trying to figure out what we are and what's the nature of reality and what's the aim of life and what are we supposed to be doing here. That's our present nature. We're in the ignorance. We're struggling. We have an urge to do something. We have many urges. We want enjoyment. We want security. We want comfort. We want to know truth. We want to be good. We want to love. We want to discover the highest reality. But it's partial, because we've not yet got the key. We've not yet got to the truth of our own being. And in the third phase, which we are now qualified, we, humanity, is qualified for, will be the deployment of all the spirit's knowledge and power for a divine being, a divine consciousness, a divine living in earth. And ultimately, if that's the truth of reality and that's the truth of the divine, that must be the aim of our life also, to move towards that as quickly and as fully as we can. So he says a progression here has for its aim a self-fulfillment here. A self-fulfillment here on earth, not somewhere else. A self-fulfillment for who? For the self. Which fortunately for us, we happen to be that self also, so it includes us. It doesn't exclude us. A self-fulfillment for everyone and everything on earth here, in the body. A progressive manifestation and revelation of being in a perfect becoming. This, he says, is the aim of the cosmos, of the aim of the divine. And it's left for us to decide how far and in what way we will make it the real aim of our lives and everything we do.
The chapter, இதுவர நம்ம இக்னரன்ஸ் நாலேஜ் எப்படி போறது, அந்த வழி தெரியாம ஒரு இடத்துல நிறைய இடங்களை எக்ஸ்பிளைன் பண்ணினாலும் எப்படி அதற்கு வர்றதுன்னு தெரியாத ஒரு இடத்த நம்ம எய்ம் என்னன்னு புரிஞ்சுக்கிறதுக்குள்ள ஒரு ஓபனிங்க கொடுத்துருக்கு. இதத்தான் அப்ப வந்து அவர் என்ன சொன்னார், எர்த் இஸ் தி பிளாட்ஃபார்ம். இங்க இருந்துதான் நம்ம ஜடமா வந்து மேல அப்சல்யூட்ல அந்த ஒன்ல போனோம்னா எர்த் தான் பிளாட்ஃபார்ம். அப்ப நாம வந்து நம்மளெல்லாம் பிரிவிலேஜ் பர்சன்ஸ், மனிதன்கிற இடத்துல நம்மளுக்கு அந்த பிரிவிலேஜ் இருக்குன்னு அப்பா வந்து ஒவ்வொரு இடத்துலயும் எழுதுறாரு. இது வந்து பூலோக சொர்க்கம், ஹெவன்கிறது வேற இல்ல, இந்த பூலோகத்துலதான் அந்த சொர்க்கத்தை கொண்டு வரணும். அந்த இடத்துல நாம அந்த எய்ம் என்னதுன்னு நாம பார்த்து ஒவ்வொரு இண்டிவிஜுவலும் அந்த மாதிரி ஸ்பிரிட்டும் கூட அந்த இன்டகிரேஷன் ரெண்டுமா சேர்ந்து வர சமயத்துல பூலோகம் சொர்க்கமாகும் அப்பா எழுதியிருக்கிறத இன்னைக்கு அவர் வந்து நிறைய கேரக்டர்ஸ் வழி, டிஃபரெண்ட் கேரக்டர்ஸ் இன் தி ஸ்டோரி வழி எப்படி அந்த எய்ம் ஆஃப் லைஃப வந்து ஒவ்வொருத்தரும் வச்சுட்டு இருக்காங்க. அதே மாதிரிதான் நம்மளுக்கும் எய்யும் இல்லையா. இப்ப மிஸ்டர் பென்னட், மிஸ்ஸஸ் பென்னட், டார்சி, எலிசபெத் இந்த டிஃபரெண்ட் கேரக்டர்ஸ், நாம அதே மாதிரி வி ஆர் டிஃபரெண்ட் கேரக்டர்ஸ் இன் அவர் லைஃப். அந்த கேரக்டர்ஸ் சேஞ்ச் ஆனா, அந்த டிரான்ஸ்ஃபார்ம் ஆனா, அந்த ரெண்டையும் இன்டகிரேட் பண்ற சமயத்துல பூலோகம் சொர்க்கமாகும். இன்னைக்கு உள்ள இந்த சாப்டரோட மெயின் ஒரு கன்க்ளூஷன்ங்கிறத மாதிரி நான் ஃபீல் பண்ணேன். நீங்களும் அப்படிதான் ஃபீல் பண்ணிருக்க நினைக்கிறேன். First, I am thanking Mr. Gary to deliver such a good speech. அவர் வந்த உடனே எங்கிட்ட என்ன சொன்னார், 2.5 மணி நேரம் இருக்கு, ஷார்ட் ஸ்பீச் தான், இவ்வளவு டைம் இட் இஸ் நாட் நெசசரின்னு. ஆனா இப்ப 2.5 மணி நேரம் நம்மளுக்கு போனதே தெரியாம போயிடுது. அதுதான் அந்த அளவுக்கு டைம் வேண்டி இருக்கிறது. ஓகே, ஐம் ஃபர்ஸ்ட் தேங்கிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி. அந்த அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் நன்றி வணக்கம் கூறி விடைபெறுகிறோம். வணக்கம்.